third case for this morning, Delta Consulting against R. Randall Construction. Mr. Witt?
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court. I'm Lynn Witt. I'm the counsel for the appellant in this case, R. Randall Construction, appealing from a granting of a motion for summary judgment with regard to a claim by Delta. I would respectfully submit to the court that in this case, Delta has not been able to sustain its burden of proof with regard to showing there is a non-existence of any genuine fact. I think just a cursory review of the briefs that have been submitted to this court, as well as looking at the underlying motion for summary judgment, indicate that this is not a single-dimensional case. It is multi-issued, had multiple facts, has a counterclaim, all of which require someone, in this case, the trier of fact, a jury demand, to review those facts and determine their validity and how they affect the respective rights of each party here in this underlying litigation.
Well, here's my problem with that, Mr. Witt. It looks to me as though the primary grounds on which the district court relied to find that there was an account stated here are, number one, this letter that came from the accountants in September indicating actually a somewhat higher amount, and then Delta corrects it down to the 81,000 in some level, and then months and months go by, number one. And number two, the exchange between Mr. Randall and the Delta people for you know, holding back on, you know, I'm going to call it forbearance, even though that word isn't quite used, for collection efforts while other, you know, while legal remedies were pursued. And the only thing I understand Mr. Randall to be saying contrary to that was in a subjective way, he didn't intend Delta to understand these things like that. But we don't use a subjective test for this. We use an objective test. And so I just don't see how you can avoid the finding that there was an account stated, and at that point he has to pay the rest of the money.
Well, the account stated, I think if you look at the cases we've cited, particularly with respect to Illinois law, is there several aspects. One is the reasonableness of any stated account, if in fact it is a stated account. If you look at the letter that you're referring to, if every time an accounting firm, as part of its rigors to do an audit of a firm, sent out letters saying, is this an amount, without anything else, doesn't say that Randall owes the money, acknowledges the money, you're simply verifying under the accounting rules or whether or not that's something that's shown on the books.
That's
verifying the amount.
That's your client's accountant.
Yeah, that's right.
Pardon? That's your client's accountant, isn't it? Acting as your agent to investigate your books.
But that's part of their normal procedure in all companies. If you look at the books, the accounting says we're going to run tests.
So your books.
This could have been one that was part of the test. It could have been one that was not part of the
right.
test.
So your books reflected $80-some thousand owing to Delta, and your agent went to verify it, and so aren't you stuck with that?
But there's no acknowledgement that, in fact, we owed it. There's lots of...
That's the subjective part of that. Your book said that. It's not. It would have been quite different if the letter that had gone to Delta had said, our books show a debt of $89,000, but we are contesting that because we don't think you performed the services for us that you agreed to perform. Anything like that. It would have been very easy to have alerted Delta to the fact that you were contesting. Instead, it's just, we want to verify that this is the amount owed, and Delta takes a look, writes back to you, says, no, it's really $81,522, and then silence from your client for 4 months, for a long time.
Well, before
why isn't there some obligation to write back and say, no, as a matter of fact, we don't think we owe you anything?
Well, I think you have to look prior to the time that occurred.
Why? Why isn't this the critical moment, and especially in light of the fact that Mr. Randall also says, can we put all of this on hold while we pursue our legal remedies?
Well, that in and of itself, Your Honor, is a question of fact. Was there forbearance? Was there an agreement or anything like that with regard to this particular aspect? if you look at the testimony from Mr. Randall, he had objected to paying this multiple times. I think if you look at the case law we cited, once you're refusing to pay, there's no obligation, no matter how many statements or things that are sent.
When are you saying he refused to pay, though? I don't see in a timely manner this refusal.
Well, let's look at it this way, Your Honor. They billed some $67,000 over a period of time that he paid.
Right.
And then because of their non-performance and inability to provide a product that was even sellable, he refused to pay any more money. If the loudest thing you say about a bill is I'm not paying you, and it goes on for a period of time.
But it, you're relying, I think, on silence. The bills are sent out, and Delta just doesn't get paid. Nobody is saying anything. And then it's Randall Construction that sends the letter out in September. I mean, I don't have any problem feeling some sympathy for Mr. Randall's frustration about all of this as you portray the facts, but the problem is that he doesn't seem to have told Delta in a way that was effective that he was contesting this bill. And as a matter of fact, one way of looking at the facts is that when it gets turned over, I guess it is to your firm, but when it gets turned over for litigation, we don't know from this record whether some of Delta's work might have been helpful in the settlement process. Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, it's really beside the point.
Well, I think it's directly to the point, Your Honor, because it goes to the refusal to pay any more money from Randall because the product wasn't usable, quite frankly.
I don't know that. There's just no payment. Then the indication that, you know, then the confirmation of the account.
Well, let's put it in the opposite way. If this is really a stated account and Delta's sitting there with some sort of an agreement, then they should be documenting that agreement for forbearance. For somebody to set out on an account for over 2 years without doing anything doesn't indicate that that's a stated account, and they're very well aware of Mr. Randall's opinion that the product's not worth what he paid, much less paying anything else, that he told him on numerous occasions before any of this happened. What you're trying to do is elevate a simple business procedure for an accounting firm that's required to go through these tests as something that's an acknowledgement by Randall that I owe the money, when all the other facts prior to that time indicate that he had already refused. And I think the case law is that once I refuse, you can send me statements forever.
But he never sent them a letter that said, I'm refusing. And I think the rule that you're arguing for would require us to assume that Illinois thinks that every late bill payment is actually a refusal to pay the bill. There are lots of people who pay their bills a little bit late, especially in today's economy, who aren't really refusing or disclaiming the debt. They're just late.
But I don't think that is the Illinois law, Your Honor, respectfully. If you look at the case law in terms of if I refused and continue to refuse, I'm not required to do that anymore.
Where's the letter where he writes to them and says, I am refusing to pay you anymore?
There is not a letter. There are many phone calls.
I'm saying if there's some documentation that somebody is not just late on a bill, but they actually are contesting the legitimacy of the bill, fine. I mean, obviously, Illinois has a different set of rules for that situation. That's a potential issue of breach of contract on either side, one side for failing to provide the required services, the other side for failing to pay. That's well established. But just being late doesn't necessarily mean you're refusing. Or absence
late,
of action.
Late is one thing, Your Honor, if I'm 3 months late or 90 days late, but we're talking about something that's over 2 years.
Well, I don't know.
You're elevating a person's refusal. If it isn't a document, it isn't real. And what I'm telling you is it's a factual issue of what that occurred and how it occurred.
The only documentation I found was a letter from your client's agent saying, our books show that we owe this amount of money. Is that right? That's the only thing I see.
The problem with that, Your Honor, is not to get into the details of Mr. Randall's business, but because of this entire circumstance, his business and his whole life was in distress, quite frankly. to the point of
whether it's
medical
in distress
problems,
or not is not materially any issue I can think of. But I say the only correspondence I see going from your client, the plaintiff in this case, is our book showed we owe this amount of money. Is that true?
But that's just an accounting. The letter does not say, Your Honor, we owe you this money.
But it doesn't say we
money.
Don't owe.
It
we
says
don't owe
here's
a
number that's on the accounting.
Well, hold it just a minute.
Yes.
It does not say our books show this, and we don't think that's right. And that's what Judge Wood said. All he said is our books show that we owe this amount of money. Is that correct?
And that's just verifying something that's entered in as an invoice.
That's right.
And
the account stated.
Before you run out of time, I'm a little concerned about Mr. Randall's individual liability here. I take it you don't contest that.
We contest that, Your Honor.
Where did you contest that?
It's in our brief. There is nothing that shows Mr. Randall ever acted individually. He only acted as a corporate officer. All payments are from Randall Construction. There's absolutely
no evidence.
But
you didn't ever, I think what Judge Tinder's getting at is you didn't say anything in the district court about that. And under Rule 9A2, if you're going to deny capacity, you have to do so specifically with particular facts. And you didn't say anything to the district court. You know, your opponents are saying you didn't raise an affirmative defense, which is roughly what 9A2 is. But 9A2 particularly addresses this.
That is what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
And your counterclaim is in both the name of the client, your client, and his company. So
it had to do with the individual circumstances in the situation, because I think you have to look at the exigencies of the situation. If the case law in Illinois recognizes previous refusals simply because there's not a document, doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has to have a document every time they do something. We've gotten ourselves into a world of documentation is the only thing that means anything. And that's not the case here. And our point is a trier of fact needs to look at these facts and determine if that's true. And that's our only point. And there's facts up and down every issue. And to just throw away a counterclaim?
If I were you, I'd save a little time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir?
You're in your rebuttal time, sir.
Oop. I'm sorry, sir. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Kaup.
Your Honors, my name is Boris Kaup, and I will be presenting on behalf of Delta Consulting, the appellee.
Mr. Kaup, can you remind me when this accounting letter was mailed?
September 30th, 2004.
So the alleged communication from Mr. Randall, let me just back up. I guess the last payment that Delta received was March 9th, 2004?
That's correct.
All right. So we're actually not talking years. We're talking
a couple of months.
All right.
What is important to note with regard to the appellant's argument, I think, is that summary judgment cannot be avoided by means of unsupported denials and implausible claims that fly in the face of the established record. Nor is a party opposing summary judgment entitled to have unreasonable inferences drawn in its favor. That's exactly what appellants are asking for.
There is something disturbing about all of this, since it looks like the letters that Delta was sending to Mr. Randall would have led a reasonable person to think that this was all going to be done for something in the neighborhood of $37,000, and all of a sudden this bill balloons up quite a bit higher than that, to the 150, 160 level.
Yeah, the initial estimate that was also specifically noted to be an estimate, said that a typical REA claim requires a certain amount of hours for phases one and two. The first phase is the familiarization phase. The second phase is the phase where Delta looks into these matters in more detail and creates a schedule analysis.
I understand that, but I mean, I think the thing that has wound everybody up in all of this litigation and expense and time is the fact that Mr. Randall, as a regular business person, could have looked at that and thought, well, you know, maybe it's going to be a little more, maybe 50, you know, you put aside, but three times that is not a small matter for people. And it just seems to me that Delta's failure to disclose a little more about the upside risk for Mr. Randall has led everybody to a world of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Delta did do what it could at that early time. This letter, mind you, that was sent, I think, in March of 2003. No, it's actually end of January 2003. Was sent before Delta was ever engaged, and had very little information about this matter.
But the fact that Delta's first estimate comes in at $1.6 million and then the revised one, $1.7 million, and the settlement offer is $100,000 suggests that Delta, if it had been the difference between $500,000 and $100,000, okay, people compromise that, but this is a huge gap.
Okay. Your Honor, for once, there was a settlement of $100,000. There was also, according to the materials that are on record, another settlement offer of, it said, about $200,000. And then the record also reflects that both Delta and the appellants were aware, of course, that the amount of $1.6 million and then the amount of $1.7 million, which the difference is made up by the retainage that was still held by the school district, was not the amount that they expected to recover, but was basically the absolute utmost amount that that could be calculated using the information provided by Randall. In fact, I think the record shows that Randall himself, in his internal documents, had a figure set aside for, I think, $900,000, which was the amount that they thought might be obtainable. And then we talk about a difference of $200,000 and $900,000, which is not, I think, that outrageous, considering that the further negotiation of this whole claim was aborted by Randall because they couldn't afford to pay Delta anymore. And so this third phase, the dispute resolution phase, could never be finished. In fact, I think Delta has pointed that out by stating that Randall ended up spending $157,000 over and above what it had incurred with Delta for a net recovery of an additional net recovery of $93,000 just by litigating this claim.
Well,
but it was premature to do so because the Landmark, the representative of the school district, had specifically stated that they remained open to resolve the REA claim, even though they had some issues with them.
Well, I understand. I mean, it's tough to go down the counterfactual route, and you can see Mr. Randall thinking, if he's already into this for $150,000, what's the ceiling? You know, he doesn't know how these fees are going to keep going up. There's one small point that I wanted to raise with you, which has to do with the post-judgment interest rate. I think the district court just got carried away with the use of Illinois law, which is correct on a lot of issues, but not the post-judgment interest.
The post-judgment interest, we would concede that it appears that federal law applies to that.
It should have been 4.14%.
I didn't verify the exact rate on that date, but it is based on that statute, I guess.
So at a minimum, we would need to send this back to the district court to enter a corrected judgment using the correct rate.
That might be so. Of course, from our point of view, this is at best a mistake, an error on the court that could have been corrected also by means of a Rule 59 or Rule 60 motion.
Have raised this point. I don't see any reason why this can't be addressed.
So at the very most, it would be Delta's position that the case could only be sent back on this post-judgment interest issue, because I think, as this court already pointed out, that there cannot be a doubt that an account stated was created. The letter that was sent out by the appellants was not simply a letter by the accountants. It was in the name of R. Randall Construction. It was signed by Ronald Randall. The return address was to Randall Construction.
And what is your basis for Mr. Randall's personal liability in this case?
Well, it's twofold. First of all, the dealings that Ronald Randall had with Delta led our client to believe that he was dealing with both parties, and that's how the claim was made.
Your estimate letter was, it did say Mr. Ron Randall, but also yeah. R. Randall Construction. Doesn't that recognize that he's doing business under that construction name?
Well, Your Honor, you could interpret that letter that way, but the dealings that the parties had with each other also bear out the other reading, and what has already been pointed out is that, first of all, the appellants have never raised that issue at the trial court.
Your invoices are sent to R. Randall Construction, not R. Randall or Ron Randall, whatever his name is, right?
I haven't looked at every, or I don't have the image of every single one in my head, so I can't affirm or deny that as I'm standing there. That might have been the case, but however that may be, the fact is that the appellants never raised this issue at the district court as they should have. And what's even more important, Ronald Randall asserted a counterclaim for breach of contract against Delta. He cannot say that he shouldn't be liable to Delta on the account stated that is based on the underlying contract ultimately, and at the same time turn around and say, but I do have a claim against you, Delta, for breach of that very same contract to which I was a stranger. That just cannot be, and that is the second basis. First, the dealings led our client to believe that he was dealing with both parties. Secondly, the appellants never took issue at the trial court level.
Forfeiture, waiver, and then a judicial admission in their counterclaim?
Yes, that's essentially, and then the affirmance by stating a claim on the breach of the contract to which Ron Randall says he wasn't a party. I have also, it is important then to deal with the counterclaim that appellants have asserted. They simply don't have a counterclaim, not for the recoupment of money in this matter, because the important thing is that Delta's job in this matter was not to guarantee a certain recovery of money or to please Landmark as the representative of the school district, but their job was to provide consulting services, and that's what they did. The record also shows that even if they had a claim at some point against Delta, which clearly they did not, they waived that claim by acting inconsistently with it time and time again. They accepted the letter that Delta sent them, that they had solicited, setting out the amounts due. They asked for forbearance. They explicitly admitted that by admitting the uncontroverted facts to that effect in the summary judgment motion.
When the forbearance arrangement is made, would you please remind me whether Mr. Randall wrote a letter asking for forbearance or whether this is an oral request?
That was an oral contract. The documentary part of that is the, I think, June 2nd, 2005 letter where Delta says we simply can't do that any longer.
That's from Delta. The only thing from his side is this oral statement,
which they confirmed by admitting the uncontroverted facts set out by Delta. So it would be Delta's position that the appellants just have taken time and again a position that was inconsistent with asserting this claim for the recoupment of monies, and that's why they waived it. And then lastly, when we come to the purported claim for attorney's fees, that is maybe the most egregious matter that has taken place in this case, because appellants seem to argue that they did lodge a claim for attorney's fees in this matter, but they have never pleaded such a claim. Instead, the claim that they submitted to the district court, and that is now on appeal, was a contrivance of appellants.
This was for this alleged third REA?
That's correct. The appellants pleaded as follows, I quote here, as a result of Delta's deficient performance and breaches of the party's agreement as set out above, Randall was forced to engage the services of another firm to entirely reconstruct its REA and represent it to the school district. Upon the preparation and presentation to the school district of the third and final REA by Randall's representative, which thoroughly addressed the deficiencies in Delta's two REAs as identified by the school districts, Randall's claims were settled in the amount of $450,000.
Did, at least in the verbal exchange with the court, wasn't that effectively withdrawn?
No, it was not. What the counsel said is that these allegations were, quote-unquote, again, absolutely not true and, quote-unquote, in need of amendment. However, they never did amend this counterclaim.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is whether that statement is something that we could just rationally take as effectively orally withdrawing it.
I don't think
that there's nothing to it, isn't it?
I don't think that this can be meant to do that because once the summary judgment motion was pending and they responded to it, it was clear that they did not withdraw that claim. And it is still clear now by the appeal that they're still not withdrawing the claim. Instead, what appellants are doing, in effect, is they look at the order of District Court Judge Reagan. And first of all, Judge Reagan chided appellants for failing to amend or withdraw their baseless counterclaim and struck it, as he was entitled to do under both Rules 11 and 12. And then he went on to say, even if that claim, even if they had amended that claim to reflect attorney's fees, it would still have failed under the American rules for attorney's fees. But, of course, that does not mean, that's dicta, that doesn't mean that this claim for attorney's fees was ever before the trial court. It is clear, I think, based on the record, that it was not, and so it cannot now be before this court. That's just simply what happened in this matter is basically that appellants wanted to throw out a counterclaim that was as high and as outrageous as they possibly could to force Delta to settle its meritorious claim, basically. That's what happened, and I think the counterclaim as to those attorney's fees was correctly stricken by the trial court under the judge's authority under Rules 11 and 12. It was, at the very least, a completely baseless claim. The case law says that where a claim is completely baseless, it can be stricken under these rules. It's also clear that Judge Reagan said in his memorandum opinion that the summary judgment motion is granted in its entirety. So if he hadn't stricken that in addition, then it is clear that he would have entered summary judgment on that basis. And I think the summary judgment was correct in all these respects and should be affirmed as to the claim of Delta and as to the counterclaim of the appellants. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kaub. Anything further, Mr. Witt?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me just make a couple of comments. I wish I could take credit for the settlement in this matter, but it was simply a matter of my clients having leverage at the time. Other parties wanted to settle their claims. And I take great umbrage that the appellee, if you simply look at the evidence, produced a product that had any effect whatsoever on that settlement. I think if you simply look at the counterclaim as a claim of misrepresentation, as has been presented in terms of what Delta said, what they were going to do, how long it was going to take them, and how much it was going to cost, it's a gross exaggeration. It ends up being almost four times. To say that you sweep that counterclaim out, even if you said this was a stated account, isn't appropriate since those are facts that have to be determined by a trier of fact. We have spent a lot of time contending with the appellee about, is this a black and white case? It can't be a black and white case. Here's your record in this case. This is the effort, 170-page briefs, to try to discern, pigeonhole every little fact about the multiple issues in this case, including the counterclaim. The counterclaim was styled as recovery of expenses, which I think is recognized by Illinois law as we set forth in the brief. I think the facts are so significant here that a trier fact has to go through them. And just to say there isn't documentation, it's the same as Delta, there really is no documentation on forbearance. But if you look at the time periods and the previous...
I mean, looking at the materials filed in this litigation, it looks as though there's an admission from Mr. Randall that he asked for forbearance. They ask for no effort to collect right now.
I believe if you look at how he qualified that statement, that he never acknowledged he was ever going to pay those people that amount of money, or whether or not there was an even a reasonable amount under Illinois law. I think there's facts that have to go to a trier of fact. I think a lot of this isn't documented, and it's for a whole lot of reasons, both on Delta and Randall's part. And with that, I would ask you to give my client his day in court. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Witt. Thank you, Mr. Kaup. Take the case under advisement.